from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The Beltline has been a big success for Atlanta, right?
There's like a real hunger among people to sort of get out of their cars and use their feet and use their bicycles. I mean, I think they expect it to be a success. I don't know if they anticipated the sort of logistical problems that are coming up on the Beltline.
That's coming up this hour. First, though, last week we heard a panel discussion I moderated about what happened to the civil rights movement after Dr. King died. A documentary called Black America Since MLK and Still I Rise debuts tomorrow night on GPB.
As the 1960s wore on, Dr. King, still only in his 30s, started to seem like an old man. Many young black activists saw him through the dark glasses of black power as someone who didn't pass the litmus test of blackness.
Here are some of your first thoughts. Veronica McClendon tweets, I hope that you have some hope to offer at the end of the show. I feel like crying. And Matt Mach writes on Facebook, I listened to the discussion this morning and heard a panelist discussing white supremacy. It was fairly appalling that she called out her white neighbor for moving into her neighborhood and giving her a hard time for destroying black wealth, which is probably untrue. I was surprised that no forward thinkers called her out. Imagine if a white person described giving a black person a hard time for moving into the neighborhood and destroying property values. Inclusion, progress, and advancement goes both ways. We love to get your thoughts always. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. A decades-old battle over Georgia water will be sorted out in the courts. The U.S. Supreme Court has appointed someone to decide whose rights to who has the rights to supply and use water in a long-standing battle between Georgia and Florida. The decision will have a major effect on agriculture in those states. GPB's Sam Whitehead reports on a farmer in southwest Georgia who's had to do some creative thinking about water conservation.
Agriculture is big business in southwest Georgia, thanks in large part to irrigation. But a decision in a Supreme Court case in Georgia's decades-long water war with Florida and Alabama could cap how much water farmers use in the Flint River Basin. So farmers are looking for new ways to use less water, and some are turning to big data to find solutions. Meet Casey Cox. She's 25 and next in line to run her family's farm in Camilla.
I'm the chief technology officer of the farm.
Is that your official title?
That is my unofficial title.
She'll be the sixth generation to grow peanuts, soybeans, and sweet corn along the Flint River. But she'll only be able to contribute to Georgia's multi-billion dollar agriculture industry if she has water.
We wouldn't be able to produce anything without irrigation, especially in dry years. We all know that we wouldn't be able to do what we do without water, and we want to make sure we're using it responsibly for the next generation.
Of the thousands of irrigation systems that tap groundwater in southwest Georgia, the Coxes have just 9 of the long metal sprinklers. Their irrigators are already efficient, thanks to a technology that knows which parts of their fields don't need water.
We are able to remove those areas from irrigation, and so we have a 15% reduction in water use every time we turn the system on.
And that saves the farm money. But irrigation is getting even more advanced. Cox grabs her smartphone and opens up an app that's linked to a soil moisture monitor.
And we can pull up this app and look at the soil moisture level in the field, decide whether we need to irrigate or not, and then I can go to the next part of the app and cut the system on or off.
It is feedback control. You're making a change, and then you're seeing if that change had the effect, and it's just a closed loop. You keep monitoring and making a change.
Calvin Perry runs the University of Georgia's Stripling Irrigation Research Park. There, among the whisper of sprinklers, engineers are working to make irrigation systems smarter.
We know there's going to be periods for our farmers to remain productive that we're going to have to irrigate. So we want to help them be as efficient as they can be when they irrigate.
Leading that charge is UGA's George Valitis. I found him cleaning sandy soil from an auger, about to install a prototype soil moisture monitor with a colleague from Japan.
As you can see out here in these plots, we have a lot of different sensors installed, and the primary reason for these sensors is to watch what's happening in the soil moisture so we can verify our app models.
Those models will eventually drive apps that give farmers watering recommendations in real time. The idea is to take the guesswork and waste out of irrigation.
We convert this information, which is raw data on soil moisture, into actionable irrigation amounts.
One test showed Valitis' system could cut a farmer's water use in half. Applied to every irrigation system in the Flint River Basin, the impacts could be huge. But Gil Rogers with the Southern Environmental Law Center worries efficiency gains won't be enough.
Farm permits for water withdrawal are very permissive in Georgia. It's basically a rubber stamp.
He says Georgia's water laws were written that way to encourage the growth of the state's farm industry.
I think the problem now is that it's become too much of a good thing, and you've got more permits issued than there is water in a lot of cases.
Rogers says Georgia lawmakers should pass more sustainable water laws and says a decision from the Supreme Court could finally force them to do so. But farmer Casey Cox isn't waiting for that. Back on her farm, she takes me through a stand of longleaf pines to the clear, quick-flowing Flint River.
We depend on this for everything, so we have absolutely every incentive to take care of it.
For Cox, being smart with water now isn't about possible usage caps. It's really not even about saving money. She says conservation is an insurance policy for her future. For DPB News, I'm Sam Whitehead.
Lawyers for both Florida and Georgia returned to court last month. It's a case that's expected to last for some time, and Dan Chapman has followed it every step of the way. He's a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and joins me now. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's try and boil, in 5 minutes, boil down three decades of litigation.
Good
Is that
luck.
Okay?
Good luck.
Why did the Supreme Court appoint another judge to look over this? Why not just take up the case?
Well, I mean, as you point out, it's been going on for decades. 27 years, I think, is the last count. And there have been so many lawsuits back and forth, so many players, so many different states, so many federal agencies, that finally the Supreme Court took it up after Florida sued again about 3 years ago and said, look, you know, you guys up north are killing our oyster industry. You're killing our way of life down here. You're killing our endangered species. This is sort of a last-ditch effort for Florida. So what they did, and smartly as it turned out, was to petition to the U.S. Supreme Court to take up the case, figuring, you know, you can't get much higher than that, and if they ultimately rule, then we'll finally have a decision on this. So the Supreme Court agreed, somewhat surprisingly, at least from Georgia's perspective, to take up the case, and so they appointed a special master, a guy named Ralph Lancaster from Portland, Maine.
All right, so was there ever an established amount of water that Georgia could take from the waterways?
A good question. Periodically over the years and after various lawsuits and findings by the Corps of Engineers and various judges, Metro Atlanta was given a certain amount. Over the years, as Metro Atlanta has grown, as the community has grown, as we've gone from 2 million, say, when the lawsuit started to 5, 6 million today, and as we're projected to go up to 10 million in, you know, 20, 30 years, we've keep gone back to the well, as it were, to get more water out of Lanier in particular.
There has, so far as I know, and I'm not an expert on this, there has not been a case of a metro area actually having to limit growth because of a lack of access to water, but that could be possible, could it not?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. So far, so good for Metro Atlanta. And as you can tell, we've been growing higgledy-piggledy for years and keep sprawling further and further outward. Water has not been, and really should not be, a problem here. I mean, we sit at the bottom of the Appalachian Mountains, which are something in the southern Appalachians of a rainforest. You know, in good years, in typical years, we get something like 60 inches of rain. That should be sufficient. But as we find out, particularly during times of drought, in which yet again we find ourselves, it just isn't enough.
Okay, so this, I mean, how important is this? Because we don't actually see a huge amount of reporting on it other than yours. This isn't a huge topic of conversation, and yet it's going to have far-reaching effects.
It, you know, I'm of two minds on that. I mean, I can write as much as I can. Y'all can do as much as you can, and other publications and shows will, you know, periodically raise the issue when it comes to some sort of legal front. But, I mean, you know, you walk around, you talk to people, and they're largely water wars. What's that? Oh, yeah, Florida. You know, what's all that about? So I think the level of disinterest is too high amongst the general public.
Especially since we're in a drought, and it could be that that the voluntary water restrictions could become mandatory.
Well, that's when people start thinking about it, obviously, but I'm not sure they quite make the connection between a drought and, oh, yeah, this Chattahoochee and, oh, yeah, Florida and Alabama want some of it.
All right. So we're speaking with Dan Chapman. He's a reporter for the AJC, and he's been following this legal battle between Florida and Georgia over water. Although, does this particular case involve Alabama? Because Alabama has been involved in some of these tussles.
Yeah, good point. And that's, no, Alabama is not directly involved in this case, although they filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief on the side of Florida, in essence saying we support Florida and we'll will accept the decision from the special master. But that does not preclude Alabama from yet again suing on the other end of this thing.
Wait, that means that even were this case to be settled by the highest court in the nation, we could end up back in court over water because Alabama would sue?
I've always looked at this story as sort of job security. You know, I've been covering it for about 10 or 12 years, and it just never ends. I mean, as an example, as they were getting ready for this case, Georgia alone had 70 attorneys. Georgia alone this year has spent $25 million just on legal fees. So no, even though we are at the highest court of the land, it may not be over. In fact, the process goes something like this. The special master will rule. Probably the trial should end by Christmas. He'll give his ruling in about a recommendation, as it were, within a month or two. That goes directly to the Supreme Court if they decide to pick it up, which is likely. But in that time, there's also a chance for further mediation between the states. And then, of course, if some state doesn't like it, well, there's always that legal route yet again.
In that time, Florida and Georgia could settle.
Yes, and that seems to be largely what the special master is angling for. In fact, in the run-up to the trial, he repeatedly said in all of the court documents when he was having teleconference calls with each side's attorneys, look, y'all need to settle this because neither of you are going to be happy with my ruling.
Okay, so, you've just laid out a timeline, which means we're going to be stuck with this for quite a while, and that's assuming that Alabama doesn't sue. What does that mean in the meantime? Does this have any effect on our daily lives right now while the case is pending?
No, it really doesn't. I think, obviously, what's going to have a greater effect is this drought. And ultimately, you would think the state of Georgia and its Environmental Protection Division would boost the drought awareness level. There's a lot of questions out there today as to why they have not. I mean, you can still go out there and pretty much water and wash your car and do all of that.
And fill your swimming pool.
Your swimming pool. And if you follow some of this stuff, the stream flows in North Georgia, whether it's the rivers or the smaller streams, are at near historic low levels.
And in fact, we just got news today that they're expecting the drought to possibly continue through the winter, which is when most of those water sources are refilled.
Yeah, one would hope. Again, typically, end of November is when the winter rains come, middle to end of November. I don't see any sign of that on the horizon, though.
Not a meteorologist, but no meteorologists are saying that we're going to get a whole bunch of rain. Okay, so when do we think the special master will rule? January?
Well, again, if the trial ends by Christmas, he likes to move this thing along rather quickly. So January, perhaps February. And then when he is done with that and he gives his ruling, and what we are anticipating is that there will be some level of pain for both sides. That would be largely a prod, I think, to get him to get both sides back to the table
settle.
To work out a deal. Yeah.
That is AJC reporter Don Chapman. He is following this battle between Florida and Georgia over water. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Christy McCrackis describes herself as a pagan agnostic, but she's been in church on many recent Sunday mornings. She's on a personal journey that involves visits with small congregations in North Georgia. Christy is a transplant from Boston and chose church as a way to get to know more about her new neighbors and what's important to them. I sat down with Christy McCrackis this month and began by asking what she considers a pagan agnostic.
Actually, I'm glad you bring that up because I learned that my definition of paganism is a lot different from Christian's definition of paganism. I walked into a Baptist church in the North Georgia Mountains in Morganton, and they told me to sit in on their Sunday school, and I've never sat in on Sunday school. And interestingly, they have a little booklet, and they were describing pagans, and I was quite shocked. So I'm certainly not...
You're actually holding a... Yeah, for the listeners out there, she's holding a kind of a book. It's a pretty thick book called Explore the Bible. Okay, so they define paganism.
Yeah, here, I'll read it. And this isn't quite the way I define it, so maybe we should work on this definition. Carrying on in unrestrained behavior, evil desires, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and lawless idolatry. So to make things clear...
Okay, that's not the official definition of paganism.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I certainly don't do all those things. For me, it just means someone who loves nature and lives by the laws of nature, sunrise, sundown, and and doesn't necessarily believe in organized religion. But agnostic there, I'm just leaving it open because I'm open to learning new things from other people.
Why choose, if you're a pagan agnostic and you're opening yourself up to the things that describe you as being drunken and participating in orgies, that's not a particularly enjoyable experience. Why would you choose church service as a way to get to know more about your new state?
Well, actually, I didn't know that was the definition of paganism until I went to Sunday school yesterday. But in addition to visiting churches, I'm also exploring the Appalachians. So I've also explored the topic of guns because there's a store called Drug and Gun. And also, I want to explore the topic of railroads in the Appalachians. So I just want to get to know the South because, as you mentioned, I'm from Boston. And when I came here, I didn't have the sense that Atlanta was the South. It's very international. I didn't meet that many people who came from Atlanta or Georgia. Everyone seemed to come from somewhere else.
A lot of people are transplants like yourself like myself.
And when I came here, I thought that I'd be greeted by Southern hospitality and I'd sit on a porch and drink mint juleps. And instead, I just met a lot of other people from big cities. When I bought the cabin in North Georgia, I wanted to explore getting to know people in the mountains and the Appalachians. And certainly being in the Bible Belt, church is a central part of people's lives. I don't want to explore it because there's a clash of ideologies on how you see the world. I want to understand people and why they go to church. Plus, I always had the sense that there's a certain sense of community in churches. And I'm kind of an outsider and I want to look in. I used to ride my bike. I still ride my bike up and down Old 76 in Morganton and notice six churches I wanted to explore.
And that became the name of your blog. You call it Six Churches, 6 Miles, 6 Weeks.
Yeah.
Did you find the sense of community that you thought would be there? Is that what you found?
To a certain extent, although one thing I found a little disappointing is that, and they're small churches, so they're more intimate, so there is a chance to get to know people. And people are very friendly. They always greet me, of course, because I'm not known. A lot of the people only seem to see each other just that day. Like, they don't seem to socialize outside unless they're doing some sort of Bible study together. And they were actually kind of bemoaning that. They thought there should be more hospitality because that was a topic of Sunday school, too.
So what have you taken away from this? Has it accomplished what you wanted in terms of getting to know your area and your neighborhood?
Well, I think what I need to do is delve deeper in now. Now that I've had an overview, I need to delve deeper. And hopefully I'll do that. I got the phone number of these people sitting near me yesterday. Actually, there was one guy who was a former pagan, but he ascribed to this paganism I just described, like drunkenness and all that.
Wait, he was a former person who did drunkenness and orgies and
now is crazy
behavior. Okay.
Yeah, he's actually from New Hampshire, so that was double intriguing that another transplant is now a Christian and doesn't drink or do anything that this definition of paganism.
Do people try to convert you?
I think that's why they always come up and shake my hand. And, you know, the last church I went to, which was across from this Baptist one, was a Methodist one. And he said, well, I hope you choose us. And, you know, we're small and friendly and we hug a lot. And so, you know,
How do you answer that, though? You're not actually looking for a church, are you?
Well, part of me is looking for spirituality, but I think that actually one thing I've come away with, I guess, is that I'll just be a perpetual outsider, maybe. You know, and you can define yourself as an outsider looking in, and you want to write about other people, but not necessarily take part in their life.
Before we leave this conversation, do you feel as though you're getting an understanding for the real Georgia from these visits?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Okay, so what is that? What does that look like? This is, at least in some measure, an authentic picture of Georgia. What does that picture look like?
First of all, I think there's a lot of vanishing Georgia, that the old Georgia is not necessarily the new Georgia. And for this project I'm working on, I also want to, you know, look at the changing face of the South, because it's not what other people might think who come in and look at the old South, at segregation or, you know, Bible Belt and people who are so ideological they don't look at other points of view. I think it's more nuanced than that. I mean, I met a lot of very nice, friendly people. I think they do have a sense of community by going to church. And they also share things like so-and-so fell off a tractor and died and someone's sick and let's pray for them. I mean, I don't think I can blindly believe that Christ will do these things.
That's probably a different issue, right? But did you find the Georgia you expected when you moved south, the Georgia that involved Southern hospitality and drinking a mint julep on a porch?
Oh, we'll see. But I guess the group I saw yesterday won't drink at all, apparently, if pagans...
Guess not.
But I've met other people where I can learn that from.
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of people in Georgia that'll teach you how to drink. My guest is Christy McCracka. She's the author of the blog, Six Churches, 6 Miles, 6 Weeks. That blog is about her visits to small churches to see what she learns about the people and the state of Georgia. And this is a personal project, Christy, that's helped you find answers to questions you didn't know you had. But my producer, Amanda, says you're an expert in something quite unexpected. That's all that I know at this point, because what we were going to do next is part of our occasional series that we call No Notes. And for this series, my producers literally sit me down with someone and give me no information. They often don't even tell me who the person is. I know who you are. What I don't know is what this thing that you're an expert in that is unexpected. So following along with me, the listeners are going to try to figure it out while I try to figure it out. You game for this?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So is it related to your writing?
Yes.
It is related to your writing.
Yes.
Is it something that you learned as a kid?
Parts of it I might have learned as a kid, but not the specialty in general, no.
So this is a specialty. Is it like an academic specialty? Are there professors of this somewhere?
More generally, I suppose there could be, but no, certainly not. I don't think there would be a professor of this topic.
Okay, so you're an expert in a particular topic. Mm-hmm. Did you write a book about it?
Oh, yes.
Okay, and I have not looked up your biography. They warned me not to do that.
Okay.
So I don't know what that book was about. But is it related to an activity? Like, is it about hiking? Is it an activity like that?
Not about hiking, no.
But isn't it about an activity?
Part of it is, yeah, certainly, yeah.
Is this a sport of some kind?
Not a sport, no.
Is it a survival skill?
It is a good survival skill, but not in the sense that you might think of it in terms of, like, if you're a survivalist.
Like finding water or something.
Yeah, but it is a survival skill for a lot of people.
Does it require another person to do it?
That's a hard question to answer. Yes and no.
Yes and no.
You said to answer truthfully.
Yes, you're supposed to answer me truthfully. Okay, this is about a topic which involves an activity which might be required to live and may or may not involve another person.
No, not required to live, but in the sense that if you're doing an activity, you might need it to survive, not food or water or whatever.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so we have to clarify what we mean by
that. Is it also involve art?
Sometimes.
Like a fine art?
It's sometimes been used in art, but that's not what the expertise or book is about.
Does it have anything to do with drawing?
Yes and no, too. I mean, again, that's why it could be related to art.
I think I'm just getting more confused. Okay. Do you have to talk in order to be able to do this activity?
No.
So you can be silent?
Yes.
Do you do it outdoors or indoors?
Usually indoors.
Does it involve specific tools?
Yes.
Okay. Are those tools sharp?
Sometimes.
Does it involve a material like wood or metal?
Sometimes wood.
Does it involve carving the wood?
Not carving in the sense that you're going to carve, you know, a piece of art. Should I give you, this will be
yes.
A big hint, writing on the wood.
So do all of us use this object that you create? It is an object you create, right?
No, we don't all use it at all, no. No,
no, but do you use it?
When I'm doing demonstrations and things, yeah.
Is it a writing utensil?
Yes, sometimes, yep.
Sometimes it's a writing utensil? Are you creating pencils?
Not pencils, no.
Pens?
Yes, certain types of pens, yeah.
A certain type of pen?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's some type of pen?
Mm-hmm.
It's a specific type of pen supposed to write a specific type of thing?
This is a big hint. I mean, you use it to communicate in a certain way.
Certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Like to create, like, Braille?
Well, you're getting warm. Not Braille. It's not for blind people.
No. I'm really hot, aren't I? I'm getting close, right?
Well, if you follow the line of thought, like why people use Braille.
Okay, so why people use Braille is because they're blind and they need to be able to feel the words. So this is a kind of writing that for also other people who have a disability of some kind?
No, they don't have any disability at all, nope.
Are they reading in the dark?
Sometimes.
So you create a specific type of pen.
Well, a pen is just one aspect of the whole thing.
You create something that creates writing.
Mm-hmm.
You create the tool that creates the writing.
Mm-hmm.
You create printing presses.
Nope.
Can this be used for all different kinds of things? In other words, can whatever it is that you're creating be used for both writing or for art?
Yeah. Some of it, yeah.
Do you create tattoo
pens? No. Should I give you another hint?
Yes, go ahead.
You had mentioned writing. You were warm.
So you create something that creates a writing of some kind.
Mm-hmm. I don't create it. I mean, of course, I can create it too, but it's something that people use. Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So why was writing invented?
To keep record of things, to communicate to other people.
To communicate.
Yes. So you create something that is used to communicate,
mm-hmm.
but it's not Braille.
No.
And it's not for people who have a disability.
Nope.
It's for anybody.
Well, anybody and certain people that especially need it.
You lost me, Christy.
I'll give you a big hint. Spies use it.
Spies use it. Well, spies have a different name. They have a code name. Mm-hmm. Is it like they're, I mean, what they have is their things identifying who they really are.
Yeah, they have a code name, but get back to communication.
Okay, Christy, what is the topic?
Have I stumped you?
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Invisible ink.
You create invisible ink, or you're an expert in invisible ink.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote a book on the history of invisible ink.
When was the very first invisible ink created?
Well, the ancient Greeks,
I was talking.
That's part of the story, and it's not lemon juice, actually. That's another topic. So invisible ink isn't just ink. It's also concealing your writing. They used to write on tablets in the ancient times, like mm-hmm. we use paper these days. They used to carve the message in it and then cover it with wax. And then they would take it to the recipient and they'd have this blank tablet. And they go, oh, why do I have a blank tablet? If you took the wax off, then you would see the message. But it's not a real good method. It's like if I give you a blank piece of paper, then people will wonder, why am I giving you a blank piece of paper?
Right. You'd have to know that you were expecting.
Because, well, then if you're an investigator, you'll be suspicious and you'll want to check it for invisible ink. They didn't start using lemon juice a lot until the Renaissance. I thought the ancient Greeks would use it because they had all these lemon trees in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
I thought that seems logical. You just squeeze some lemons. But it wasn't until the Renaissance that they started using lemon juice, probably from Italy and the Medici and all that.
Christy Makrakis, multifaceted expertise. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Christy Makrakis is a professor at Georgia Tech. Her book is called Prisoners, Lovers, and Spies, The Story of Invisible Ink from Herodotus to Al-Qaeda. We have links for her Six Churches, 6 Miles, 6 Weeks blog posts at our website, gpbnews.org. And here's another way to get to know this state, through food. There's no shortage of meal delivery services these days, but only one boasts fresh ingredients grown right here in Georgia. Peach Dish is a monthly subscription service that delivers what you need to make Southern-inspired meals. And so we thought we'd try a Peach Dish meal for ourselves. Producer Taylor Gantz and I placed an order, met in the GPB kitchen, and then went to work creating beef tacos with red cabbage slaw, radish, and lime. I've never used a meal delivery service, although I will say that in New York, we have Fresh Direct, which is a grocery delivery service, and that is fabulous. I wish we had that here. But I've actually written letters to Fresh Direct saying, please come to Atlanta, and that is not a joke.
Any response? Like, hey, we're thinking about it? Or?
They said, we're so glad you enjoy the service so much. Sorry we don't serve your area.
Yeah.
Which I felt was just rubbing it in. So, you know, it looks like you just chop a cabbage the same way you chop an onion.
Long ways than short ways, basically?
Basically. Mm.
Do you cry when you chop onions, Celeste?
You know where the crying comes from.
No,
it's
I don't.
Because these are cells are filled with juice, so you cut and it's actually hits your eyeballs.
It's actually onion cells?
Yeah, these are, like, they're mostly, an onion is mostly water. It's the science of cooking, Taylor Gantt.
What kind of beef are we working with today?
We don't know. It just says ground beef. White Oak Pastures, though, in Lufton, Georgia.
Oh, very good.
Okay, so time to make plates.
A little relish. Ooh la la, very good. Get a little more on there, and we'll grab a little bit of this, sprinkle, a little bit of lime, definitely some cheese. Put that on there as well.
I need another bite.
Okay. Gotta build up to it.
Well, that time I just got a great big huge hunk of cabbage. That's good.
Ah, right.
I would take credit, but all I did was carry out the instructions, so I can't really. But it's good.
That's two thumbs up for those who can't see. Mmm.
That tastes really good.
Right?
Well done, Miss Headley. Hmm.
Well done, Peach Dish. The Atlanta Beltline is a very popular project here in Atlanta, but one side effect of that popularity is the steep rise in home prices near the trail and the removal of some historic landmarks that stood in the way. Ryan Gravel was the lead designer of the Beltline, and Gravel recently resigned from the Atlanta Beltline Partnership because of concerns that the Beltline is now inaccessible and unaffordable to many. He joins me now. Ryan, it's good to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Can we go back over the reason? I know you've talked a lot about why you stepped down from the Beltline Partnership, but can we just quickly go over what those reasons were?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, the Beltline has, the intent of the Beltline always was to encourage redevelopment and revitalization of neighborhoods. And with rising land values and taxes and rents, of course, comes sort of threats of displacement. But because we, from the beginning, had a very inclusive, diverse coalition of people who made the Beltline happen in the first place, we're accountable to everybody, and, you know, not just abstract populations of people, but to my friends and neighbors. So while the Beltline is absolutely a tremendous success so far, in order to make sure that it's a success for everyone, we have to really follow through with the policies and things to support everybody. And you know, with the growing sort of economy and the rush to development around the corridor, that's exciting, but it also means that the urgency of responding with those policies is increasing. And so we just need to double down or quadruple down on that.
How could you have averted that? I mean, it stands to reason that the Beltline being so popular, people are going to want to buy houses there. And as more and more people buy homes there, home prices are going to go up. How could you avoid that?
Sure. Well, one thing that we have done already, I mean, for example, in the beginning, because there were people at the table who were part of our movement that really cared about affordability and the people along the way, we made sure that the tax allocation district has 15% of it goes to affordable housing. That's a significant investment in affordability. They're committed to 5,600 units over the 25-year life of the TAD. That's significant, but when, you know, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the need. There's all kinds of things that cities do everywhere about affordability. The question isn't so much about what we need to do. I'm not an expert on housing policy, but we have to do them. You know, we have to follow through. So that's everything from, you know, traditional sort of conventional investments in subsidies and public housing, those kinds of things. But it's also things that don't cost the city a dime, like unlocking some barriers to affordable development through, you know, a regulatory environment, you know, making sure that zoning kinds of issues and allowing shared housing, small housing, intergenerational kind of housing. And really not just in the city and not just on the Beltline, but region-wide.
Well, since you mentioned that, not just on the Beltline, this is a trend that is city-wide in Atlanta. The vast majority of new housing that goes up is
right.
luxury
right.
housing. Why do you think that trend continues and even strengthens? Why is this not a bigger issue, do you think, for our leaders?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think it's hard is the problem. You know, it means that we have to do things, and we have to, you know, have very tough conversations and make investments in people that is sort of a long-term investment, and it's easier to make sort of the short-term, just focus on the short-term. It's also important, though, to see that this is a national thing. This is not just Atlanta. And you look at San Francisco, you look at New York, you look at the unaffordability of those places. This has been coming for a long time. And in any city across the country that has a growing economy, this is what is happening. So Atlanta's not unique in this regard. Atlanta is sort of behind the curve a little bit. So we see, we have some time. We see what's happening and where we're going. We just have to get ahead of it. I'm really optimistic about it, actually. I think that we will do it. But I think that the Beltline is part of the answer. Because you're right, the answer to affordability is not to not build the Beltline. The answer is not to not improve communities, to not build trails or not build transit or parks or grocery stores, to not improve schools. That's not the answer to rising taxes and rents. You know, there are financial problems. And we have to tackle them with financial tools. And there's all kinds of things that we can do. And there are things that the region already does. For example, in Cobb County, you know, when you're over 60-something years old, you don't pay your school proportion of your sales tax or your property tax. That would be half your tax dollar, property taxes in the city of Atlanta. So if you're a senior on lower fixed income, that's something you could do. Now, I'm not proposing that that's the policy we should do. There's plenty of people who say that's bad policy, actually. But those are the kinds of debates that we should be having, because in lots of places, I mean, there's all kinds of tools. You go to the Housing Forum. There are people, experts in Atlanta who know what we could do. What we have to do is translate that and get the public, in the same way that the public made the Beltline happen in the first place, the citizens of Atlanta believed in this project and spoke up and said, we want this to happen, and empowered and eventually obligated the political leadership to do it and the business leadership to do it. We can do the same thing with affordability. We just have to say that we want it. And when you look at the broad spectrum of people that affordability is sort of is becoming a challenge for, that seems really possible. We're not talking only about the people who are in the lowest end of the economic spectrum. We're talking about the solidly middle-class people in the city of Atlanta who won't be able to afford it for long. And so I'm out in the community all the time, and your promo said that I was leaving the project. I'm not. I'm around. I'm happy to help anybody who wants to help it. I use it every day. I'm on it. I talk about it nationally. This is a national and global kind of phenomenon, and there's no silver bullet.
I'm speaking with Ryan Gravel. He was the lead designer of the Atlanta Beltline, and we would love to hear from you. If you're in Atlanta, have you used the Beltline? What did you like about it? What did you not like about it? If you're outside Atlanta, would you want a project similar to this in your own community? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation happening on Facebook as well. How is this debate on affordability different from the debate over historic sites that were either razed or in some way affected by the construction of the Beltline?
Well, I want to clarify that. I don't know of any structures that were in the way in terms of the construction of the Beltline itself, outside of some railroad bridges, a couple railroad bridges or two. The real impact on preservation is in the redevelopment that's coming.
Right.
And, you know, Atlanta, unfortunately, does not have a strong history with preservation of physical buildings.
Yeah, we tear stuff down.
Right. And so I think that's changing. I mean, certainly if you care about, I mean, a lot of people care about preservation, but not so much about any individual building, but they want to live somewhere that's special. They want to live in a place that has character. And as we've lost a lot of that, you know, people are starting to realize that we need to keep more. So again, I'm optimistic about that. Certainly the economy, the future economy, when you look at where cities are going, the economy is going to places that have character and meaning and history. It doesn't have to be the most special place in the world, but it does have to have something that gives it some level of interest. It's hard to recreate that with new construction. And so I think when you look at it from not merely a sort of historical standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint, there's a lot of value and momentum in saving things now. But you know, obviously we've just lost, it seems like we lost six things this week.
This is a difficult debate, though. And I followed much of what went on in San Francisco as well, because we live in a capitalist democracy, right? Which means that if you want to buy a piece of land and build a luxury property, you're allowed to do that. Right. And because the areas around the Beltline are very desirable, a lot of people are going to want to do that. Right. They're also going to want to build a Whole Foods as opposed to, say, an Aldi, because you make more money. The more money you can make, the more profits you can make in our system. That's absolutely fine. And there's the other side of it, which is in order to create affordable housing, that means the city loses tax dollars, right? It might get more tax money off of a luxury
property.
In
the short term, but not in the long term.
Now, explain that.
Well, because affordability is more than just feeling sorry for poor people, although we should do that. It's about an investment in our future. And if you look at a place like San Francisco, the people who work the convention hotels can't live there. The people who work the service industries can't live there. The police and firefighters can't live there. The ordinary Americans can't live there. And if you're creating cities that are so expensive that only the upper class can live there, it's not gonna be the kind of place that where the economy, I don't know how to explain it exactly. I mean, I think this is a new kind of paradigm, but you see like young people and artists leaving places like New York and San Francisco and going to places like Detroit where they have opportunity, and that opportunity comes with affordability and character and all of those other things. And so I think, you know, I don't think there's any answer. I certainly don't have any answers. I don't know.
The other complication here is it gets to a pretty deep sort of underlying debate, which is we have this Beltline, which is a beautiful project.
Sure.
And it was built largely with public funding.
Well, yeah, kinda. The trail that's out there now the trail is built with private money, the East Side Trail.
Okay.
The land was public money.
Sure. Right. Okay. But then it gets down to the access. In other words, because this is on public land, are we shutting out people because of their income levels, which kind of is a broader debate going on in the U.S. right now? Should everybody have access to this public place?
Part of the beauty of the Beltline is that it is accessible to everyone. We're just not finished with it yet. And the West Side Trail that's under construction now goes through very underserved communities. It's the first major investment in those neighborhoods in 30 or 40 years. So you are creating access to communities in a way that's really profound. And in fact, at the time that we started the Beltline going, I mean, it's a 22-mile loop, it's 45 neighborhoods, and I'd say two-thirds of those would be considered underserved communities. And so that's changing. The question is, are we going to protect the affordability so that the people who made the project happen get to stay? There's room for new people. This is not about keeping new people out. This is just about preserving the ability for the people who made it happen to stay and enjoy the economic and health and physical, all the different benefits of the project. And it's also important, just one note, more note, to say that we're far from done. It's more than just a trail. I mean, this is a transit project. The transit is what makes it for everybody. The good news out of last week was that we did pass the referendum that's going to allow us to build the transit. That's a huge investment in affordability and the life of people. But we do still have things we have to follow up on to make sure that it works for everybody.
That is Atlanta Beltline designer Ryan Gravel. Ryan, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Now let's talk about another issue associated with the Beltline: congestion. Anyone who goes to the Beltline on a Saturday will likely find it's pretty crowded. And all those crowds mean it's not entirely safe. On Second Thought, producer Trevor Young tells us what the city is doing about that.
It's a sunny afternoon on the Beltline, and it's packed with joggers, dog walkers, cyclists, and Beltline volunteers.
Have a good day. Stay safe.
It's all part of an etiquette campaign aimed at keeping everyone on the trail safe. Jessica Davis is one of the volunteers.
I think a lot of people have a lot to learn when walking the trail, since it is fairly new to walk on alongside the trails. I think that the campaigns make sure that people know and are aware of the rules and how to stay safe.
Those rules include keeping dogs on leashes that are 6 feet long or less, staying on the right side of the trail, and walking only two people wide. That last rule is one cyclist Brandon Englehart finds most pedestrians don't follow.
When I see big groups of people, like, you know, five, six, they'll, you know, stand side by side. And, you know, there's two lanes here, coming up, coming down. If you have a group of people, be respectful, you know, just travel in twos, you know what I'm saying?
Englehart says he's got ideas for how to address that.
Put up signs like every mile or so, or every 2 miles, or, you know, something like that. Or maybe a sign like at the beginning and at the end of it, like, hey, be respectful, watch for bikers, all that stuff.
Now that's a cyclist perspective, but here's pedestrian Martha Hartzell. She's on the trail with friends from out of state.
I think that something has to be done so that bikes are isolated from walkers. And these guys are from Minnesota, and they do. They have a bike area separate from a walking area, and it's a lot safer.
The Beltline is already expanding to other areas of the city, and director Lee Harrop hopes the increased trail space will thin out congestion. But the pace of progress has been slow, and demand is increasing rapidly, Harrop says. He thinks there may be some innovative ways to adjust.
Some of these things, like places for people to pull off the trail and rest, putting in the 3-foot shoulders, things like that that we didn't we kind of thought about during the East Side Trail design, but didn't think it was going to be something that we had to do right away.
They're a victim of their own success, right? Like, all congestion means is that there are a lot of people that want to get to a particular place at the same time. And that's actually a good thing. That's an indicator of sort of economic prosperity and economic activity.
Georgia Tech professor Alex Karner studies urban design and planning. While he says Beltline traffic signals a positive shift in the city, he also thinks the Beltline can't take the heat forever. At some point, he says, the city needs to develop more alternatives.
There seems to be a real hunger for this type of stuff, and just giving people more opportunities to walk and bike in different places that aren't the Beltline. In Atlanta, that's really one of the only places, and I think that's why it's so packed.
But the amenities the Beltline offers make it an attractive place. And people like cyclist Brandon Englehart say it's worth it.
The Beltline's been a huge help getting, you know, across town. You gotta understand, the weekends, if one comes to the Beltline, there's gonna be people.
Living in Atlanta, he says he's no stranger to traffic. But he'd rather be surrounded by dogs and people than cars. For GPB News, I'm Trevor Young in Atlanta.
And that's our show for today. But as always, we'd love to hear from you. So tell us, do you visit public parks and trails? And would big crowds keep you away? What draws you to a public trail? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on the Twitter. The show is at OSD Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. Or find us on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.